I'm here for Ayanna Jones. I'm here for so many black women, so many black men, so many Latino women.
Was not filmed, Minnesota and the rest of them would be trying to play a cover-up. They almost tried to pull it this morning by saying once we put him in handcuffs, he started having medical issues. He didn't have no medical issue. He didn't, but nothing wrong with the man when he came and walked into Cub Food. The only thing they was able to do is try to claim he got medical issues. If your knee in my neck for more than 10 minutes, I'm going to have medical issues too, and I'm going to die just like he did.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. My, what an eventful time it has been lately, huh? Live this morning from the studios of WFAN. Yes, from the studios of WFAN. You know, first of all, this city is basically still like a ghost town. And then there's this building. My goodness, there's so much space here. We could have played a football game, literally, in terms of the open space that there is around here on different floors. Well, good morning. Welcome to our program. We have a very special program today that is going to cover a number of areas, and we're obviously getting into discussion in part as a result of the recent events involving the life of George Floyd, the protests in the aftermath of his killing in Minneapolis, his funeral, memorial service, the way in which this country has been gripped in a fashion that has not occurred here at this level for quite some time. And that's a great motivator for speaking with the guest who is joining us. I'm very pleased to say on our program today, we're joined by the president and CEO of New York's Urban League. We'll find out about the Urban League in the course of our discussion. Arva Rice is joining us on our program. And we're going to be talking about this concept of why black people still can't wait. Arva, good morning. It's nice to have you join us on our program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation.
At this time, you know, there's so many different areas where we can go in discussion. How have you been moved by what you've seen in terms of the outpouring of emotions in this country?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have been asked, how is this moment different? And I think that I am not old enough to have marched during the Civil Rights Movement, but my parents were around then, and I think that this moment is somewhat different. I think it's different because the outpouring, first of all, the numbers of individuals that we have seen on the streets, it's intergenerational, it's biracial, it is individuals who are all around the country who are focusing in on this moment. And as we all know, it was after the coronavirus hit us, and sent us all to our homes. And so even if you were an essential worker, once you got home, there wasn't any place for you to go, right? And so because of that, we were all focused on the same thing at one time. And so we all looked at George Floyd. We all saw the video at the same time, and it caused this common outrage. And so the coronavirus, this disease that has no vaccination, has no vaccine, caused us to look at what I believe is America's original disease, which is racism.
I'm struck, I'm sure you're struck as well, by the fact that so many of the individuals on the streets speaking out are relatively young.
Mm-hmm.
What message does that send?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's that we all have our time of awakening. For my mother, who was born in 1946, hers was Emmett Till. For myself, it was Rodney King. For some of the young professionals I work with in my organization, originally it was Eric Garner, and now they're with some of the newer ones who have joined the program. Now it's this moment with George Floyd, and let's not forget the tragic loss of Ahmaud Arbery as well as Breonna Taylor that have together brought about this moment in time. And unfortunately, I think that every generation has to fight for freedom. And so this is their moment when they are realizing that there is still work to be done, that there's injustices that need to be fought. And so there's people who are taking to the streets and marching every day or every weekend or every opportunity that they have. And then there's others who are taking on really courageous conversations in their workplaces, even if their workplaces are on Zoom calls. But they're starting to look at this and address this issue in a way that it has not been done before.
And doing that is the natural thought, because, you know, many of us tend to be very skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there'll be a strong reaction initially, and then things kind of sort of fade away very often. That generally has been the history of events. But we're seeing something quite the opposite. It almost seems like the intensity is building.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing that?
Yes, I think that this moment is different because once people took to the streets and started to make a demand for whether it's defund the police, whether it's just, you know, hands up, don't shoot, and, you know, using more rhetoric, there was a set of legislators who were already in place and available to start to put into place legislation. So in New York City, for instance, as the governor, as we know, has passed a set of legislation that is forward-thinking and something like we've never seen before in the Say Their Name reform agenda. That reform agenda is built on a set of legislation and policies that came from different legislators that have been proposed over the course of the last 5, 6, 7 years, and they just never were passed before. And so being able to have State Senate leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins as the leader, being able to have Carl Hastings in the assembly as the leader, they were able to push forward this legislation and get things done in a record amount of time. So they had, what's different about this moment in time is that we have legislators who are sympathetic to these issues, who already were looking at these issues, who had a set of solutions and were able to push those forward. So if ever there was a moment for us to say why voting matters, it's this one right now.
And this, I guess, is a way of answering those of us who at times are very skeptical about lawmakers. And
absolutely,
you know,
mm-hmm.
We're actually seeing things enacted, seeing people live up to promises that they're making.
Absolutely. And let's be clear, we understand the skeptics. The moment that we're having in time right now is built over, you know, 400 years of oppression. But it's also, for those of us who've lived in New York City, it's Yusuf Hawkins and it's Sean Bell and it's Eric Garner. So there's a reason why we're skeptical, because we've seen people either not be charged. We've seen people be charged and actually, you know, getting not guilty sentences. And so we don't have a record of justice here. So there's a reason for the skepticism, but there's also a reason for the hope because of what we've seen over the course of the last week.
So in terms of what's actually needed, I mean, it's a multifaceted approach. I know that you are advocating, but Let's start by talking about this whole idea of the justice system, because you've alluded to this a couple of different times, and even in the opening of our program today, there was a comment that was being made about that. We're hearing an awful lot of calls for reform of the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
How does that really start?
Well, I mean, it definitely starts with some of the legislation that Governor Cuomo has proposed, passed, and signed within the last 2 weeks. And so I think that it's important for us to have, we ask for a repeal of 50A, and for your listeners, 50A is legislation that for a long time kept the general public from knowing about a police officer's record. And so now that information will be publicly available. We wanted to bar chokeholds. It didn't make any sense that a police officer could do a chokehold of someone and that not be considered unlawful. And so being able to put that in place, we unfortunately, so many of us saw Amy Cooper make that phone call where she weaponized being a black man watching a bird, doing bird watching in Central Park. And so now we're prohibiting false 911 calls. And then we're also designating an AG, the Attorney General, as an independent prosecutor when there are times when police officers have misconduct. For so long, we've heard that in the police department, you're going to have a few bad apples, but the majority of police officers really do their job well. It's a tough job, and they're committed to it. And we believe that. We do believe that the majority of police officers are good police officers. However, we don't know any other industry where it's okay to have a few bad apples. In the airline industries, you can't have a few bad apples who crash planes. In the restaurant business, you can't have a few cooks who kill their patrons. So why is it okay for there to be a few bad apples in the policing department? So I really am excited about having the Attorney General as the lead independent prosecutor, also because I'm a huge fan of our existing Attorney General. But I think that that's some of the legislation on the state level. And then, as you also know, there's the Justice and Policing Act that was also proposed that looks at some things that should be done on the federal level as well in order to call for additional accountability and also to create a national registry. So a police officer can't do a number of different wrongdoings in Illinois and then, move to California. No one ever know what he did in Illinois and continue that behavior in another state.
Is it me, or does that surprise you that there isn't already a system of checks and balances in place to prevent that sort of thing from even being a possibility? Especially in an age where, there's so much information available. I would think that should already be part of, quote unquote, the system.
Right. And I think that that's what this moment is about. I think it's a moment for all of us to be working with the same set of information. And I, as a, an African American woman who was raised by individuals who picked cotton in the South and moved to the North in order to build a better life for their children, I am not surprised by these injustices. But I think that for the rest of many other people in the world who that's not their life experiences, they're finding out that basic things that should have been in place are not.
Okay. Now, this leads us perfectly into an area that we've heard talked about a lot, and it seems that every time this comes up in discussion, there also needs to be, or also is taking place, an explanation of exactly what is meant by this idea. And specifically, I'm referring here to the concept of defunding the police, because we hear people call for that at times.
Mm-hmm.
What's your reaction to that idea, first of all? And secondly, is it realistic?
Mm-hmm. So there are some individuals who believe that defunding the police entirely would lead to more community policing, would lead for this idea and notion of accountability would go away because we would no longer have the police and its structure that we have right now. Our governor has suggested that in his most recent executive his most recent executive order that police are now responsible for developing plans that talk about how they will do better policing, and that those plans are required by April of next year in order to receive continued funding from the state. At the New York Urban League, we believe that there is funding that should be reduced at the New York City Police Department and better suited in the investment with human services and also additional programming for our children and families. What we mean specifically by that is there are a number of assignments that were given to the police department over the course of the last few years. That includes police officers in schools, police officers being responsible for responding when individuals and households were having issues with individuals who had mental health issues. And we think that we would be better off served as a community if there were a different set of individuals who were responsible for dealing with disciplinary issues in school buildings, and were responsible for dealing with people who had mental health issues in families in community situations. And so we don't believe in defunding the police entirely, but we do believe that the police officers' budget should be reduced, particularly because over the course of the last 5 years, we have seen a reduction in violent crimes. We've seen a reduction in general crimes in the city, and the NYP budget has continued to increase. And so we think that there are some specific assignments that have been given to NYPD that could be better implemented with other city agencies.
You know, one of the things that struck me literally today as I was coming to the station, to the building, because to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't been in the city since the beginning of March.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck by exactly how many boarded up windows mm-hmm. I was seeing going through different neighborhoods and just looking. I mean, that's one of the images that does not come across clearly in news coverage. And I've seen a lot of the news coverage from a variety of different sources, but you don't really get a flavor of this unless you're physically on hand. And then, I mean, it's almost overwhelming when you see that. And my reason for bringing this up is, unfortunately, at times, there have been incidents where there have been peaceful protests taking place, and then violence will break out.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it has gotten very, very unruly at times. Does that, the incidence of the violence, does that take away at all from the effect, the real message of the protests? Or is this something that can be attributed to individuals who maybe have nefarious motives for even being part of a protest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important for us to recognize that there are people who are protesting, and they are protesting injustice. Then there are individuals who are rioting, who are there just to incite violence and mayhem. And then there are people who are looters. And so it's three very different groupings of people. Does looting and rioting take away from the protest message? Absolutely. But people are angry. Like I said, this is not just about these three individuals, Breonna Aboud and George Floyd, who were tragically taken from us. It's about Trayvon Martin, and it's about Sean Bell. It's about Yusuf Hawkins. It's about Amadou Diallo. It is about decades of mistreatment at the hands of the police. And so there are individuals who are going to work very hard at putting together legislation, and that is their role, and that's how they're going to make change. And then there's going to be individuals who march and are able to engage in peaceful protest. And then there are others who unfortunately see this as their only opportunity to, you know, grab this bag or to, you know, grab this TV set. But the fact is that, you know, whether there are looters or not, there are injustices, and that's what we need to be focused on.
It's important to keep that focus, but I guess the question I'm raising becomes one of public perception, mm-hmm. in terms of how it is that the protests are then viewed. Is this something that can be attributed to media coverage? Is the coverage at times skewed to the fact that, you know, looting will break out, violence breaks out? Is it too much attention that's focused on that and perhaps not enough being focused on the peaceful side of what took place?
Well, I mean, Fox News has definitely been accused of re-showing some of the images in Minneapolis of some of the looting that took place during the very first few days and not showing as much of the peaceful protest. We understand that, you know, things that are sensational sell. So I think that there can be a tendency to focus in on the violence. But once again, the violence that caused all of this is the fact that there was a knee on the neck of a person for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And that's what the big violence is that we're talking about right now.
That
should be the focus of the conversation.
That incident, when you heard that that had taken place, and when you saw the video the first time, what was your reaction?
I have to say that the first time that I went to watch the video, that I couldn't watch it all the way through. It was too painful. It hurt too much. And it took me 3 times before I was able to watch it all the way through. It was a moment of not again. It was a moment of fear of how this would impact our communities, never having any sense that there would be a worldwide outcry. And then there was a secondary moment for me, and that was being part of one of the rallies that our public advocate, Jumaane Williams, put together. And at the close of the rally, he had everybody go into Flatbush Avenue, stopped the street for a few moments and had everybody kneel in the middle of Flatbush Avenue. And we knelt for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And so to experience that in that way really hit me in a way that working in this movement has never hit me before. And I think that my moments of being in Flatbush Avenue or other people's moments of just, you know, sitting and watching it on television and or marching in the streets has caused for an awakening in our city, in our country, and in our world that we've never seen before.
In terms of the federal government and the federal action that is needed to take place, do you feel that there's receptiveness on the part of the administration for that to move forward?
I think it's going to be harder to push forward the legislation at the federal level. I definitely applaud our own Congressman Espia for the role that he has taken. Obviously, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, for the leadership roles that they played, Jerry Nadler for his work. I think that it is bold and courageous. I do have my concerns because we do not, just because of the Democratic-Republican divides at the national level, whether we'll be able to push forward the level of legislation that is necessary at this time, but we have to keep pushing for it. It's important, and we have people in key levers of power that, once again, we didn't have, you know, 30, 20, 10, or 5 years ago. And so we'll push and get and move forward as much as we can. And the National Urban League, of which I am a member, has been pushing very hard on this legislation in order to make sure that it is pushed forward.
I didn't ask you, and I did it purposely, at the beginning of our discussion, Can you explain exactly what the Urban League does?
Sure. Urban Leagues were started over 100 years ago when individuals were making the great transition from the South to the North. We were facing lynchings, and we were facing a level of injustice that was, you know, unprecedented. Individuals were, you know, getting lynched, and the NAACP was counting, those lynchings on a daily basis. And they started 1 year before the New York Urban League, and the New York Urban League was always focused on the economics and wanting to provide equal rights and equal justice for individuals. And so the first Urban League was started in New York City and spread throughout the country and provided opportunities for education, employment, housing, and healthcare for individuals who are making that move in that great transition. And so now, over 100 years later, the New York Urban League still works in education, employment, and advocacy, helping individuals to go to college, providing them with scholarships, helping individuals to find employment, and also providing an advocacy agenda and speaking out and speaking boldly when there are inequalities that happen in our country, particularly in our city. And the New York Urban League is one of 90 Urban League affiliates around the country. And we believe that inequality is unacceptable. And so we work and fight to empower communities and change lives every day.
How do people who are listening to our discussion today find the New York Urban League? And are there ways that they can be supportive of your efforts?
Absolutely. So we can be found on the web at www.nyul.org. That's nyul.org. We, like the rest of the businesses around New York City, we're moved to do our work virtually. And so we have been providing virtual programming over the course of the last 10 weeks during New York pause, but we have still been able to serve our children and families virtually. We've launched a family fund for individuals who have been impacted by COVID-19 and so are looking for support for rent and housing and utilities and all those sorts of things. And so we'll be providing cash grants to them, and people can contribute to that grant fund, and then also support our overall work as we look to put together an agenda that really looks at how we can improve policing, but also help our workplaces be more responsive and reflect the diversity of our great city.
We're talking on our program On the Fan with Arva Rice, who is president and CEO of New York's Urban League. She's joined us by phone. I'm Bob Salter. Along at 7 this morning, it's Ann Liguori's Talking Golf at this time of the year. Now, one of the things I was thinking heading into our discussion today, too, is to talk about this idea, because this also has been brought up a number of times, of how it is that we heal in this country and how we move forward in that fashion. Because I'm also thinking about, does this idea of respect for one another play a big part in that healing?
Mm-hmm. I think it's about respect for one another, and I think it's about increased awareness. This moment in time, as I mentioned, is unprecedented. You know, we've never been everybody forced to be at home at the same time. We're consuming the same things. And so it has brought in a heightened level of awareness. And so there are individuals who will now walk into, you know, stores and bodegas and restaurants and have a heightened awareness of whether the Black family sitting next to them has to sit and wait longer before the waitress comes over and takes their order. And so that level of heightened awareness, we hope, will not just last for a week or a month, but that it will be sustained. We hope that that corporations, workplaces will open themselves up to conversation. I have had numbers of our corporate donors who have called us and said that they want their corporation to not only issue a statement, but they want to talk about how they can diversify their workplace. And so how can they partner with the New York Urban League seek to help make that happen? How can we help them to identify talent? How can we help them to identify individuals for their boards of directors? How can we help them to structure a conversation so that their employees can talk about race and have these courageous conversations? So we hope that this is not just a particular moment in time, that when we move into phase two of NY Pause, that people kind of remember this is just an activity that they did when they were part of New York Pause, but then they went back to things being the way that they were. We hope that this is a moment that people look back on and it significantly changed forever the way that they think about race and the way that they interact with their colleagues and also with their community.
Is it wrong, you know, in response to what you've just said, for some people to also think, isn't it about time?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes. Isn't it about time?
You know, to go back to this point that I raised at the very beginning of our discussion today, because you wrote about this, why Black people still can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
What motivated you to put your thoughts in writing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt motivated to talk about what this moment in time is about, to say what are some of the things that would improve the moment. So to write about, as you know, the Why We Can't Wait reference is a book that was written by Dr. Martin Luther King when he was jailed. And so he wrote a letter at first to some of the individuals who were his critics, as well as some of the folks who were his supporters, saying why that particular moment in time was important for Black people to have a set of demands around civil rights. And so we're in a similar moment right now. And so I thought it was important for us to talk about what are specifically some of the things that we wanted in terms of police reform. And as I mentioned, the Say Their Name reform agenda speaks almost to every one of those that we talked about. I thought it was important for us to say what allyship could look like. And by that, I mean, how can we partner with white people who are concerned, who are being awakened? And for some of those who have been our allies along the way, how can they move to being co-conspirators and help us to set an agenda that they can partner with along the way? And then I thought it was important for us to have some things that we can do as individuals. You know, like I said, this moment is a salient call for the importance of voting. We need to make sure that we respond to the census. We need to make sure that our giving is reflective of our values, whether it's giving to the Urban League, whether it's giving to the NAACP, whether it's contributing to Black Lives Matter or to the ACLU, but then making sure that we have an individual investment as well. And so I thought that in this moment, it was important to have the Urban League's voice providing an analysis of the moment, but also some concrete steps on how we can move forward.
Those three words we're hearing a lot, seeing indelibly imprinted into our minds, Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it that that message keeps at the forefront?
Mm-hmm. It's important because, you know, I woke up a week after the George Floyd's murder, and I went onto my Facebook page. I'm originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I saw the Facebook post of one of my former high school mates, and she said that after watching the George Floyd video that she had been called to rethink her thoughts on All Lives Matter, and that she now understood that Black Lives Matter was a call for a recognition that some people's lives are valued more so than others, and that Black Lives Matter is such an important call to action. And I think that that's why it's important that we continue to focus on that. It's not about the vandalism that's happened. It's not about the rioting that's happened, but it's about the fact that some lives continue to be valued more than others. And that is codified in our legislation. it is put deeply into our laws and our policies and our practices. And it is up to every one of us as individuals to ask how we're working individually and as a group and a collective in order to eradicate racism in our city, our country, and our world.
And to get those laws, those policies addressed, does that begin with conversation?
It absolutely begins with first awareness, recognizing that the saying of Black Lives Matter is important, because there is a conversation that Black families have to have with their sons and their daughters that white people do not have to have. And as long as that is the case, that is an inequality that we do not believe is acceptable. And so until that, we have a recognition, first of all, that there is an equality that is there, then we move towards putting together conversations, laws, practices that can move us towards eradicating those differences.
When you say there's that conversation that has to take place by Black parents with their sons, their daughters, some people listening to our discussion today, I'm assuming, may not know what you mean by that. How do you make them aware of what you're talking about?
I mean, I think it's about having having conversation. As I mentioned, I've had a number of our corporate donors who have called us and wanted us to help to assist them in conversations that they're having in their within their workplaces, and helping to develop moving beyond just their statement denouncing racism, but what happens after that. And one particular partner that we have who has done extremely well, an African-American professional, lives in a wonderful suburb in Westchester, and had that moment when he turned and he saw that his son was going to take his car and, you know, going to go see one of his friends, and realized that his son, you know, had his hoodie pulled up over his head and was about to step into a Land Rover and drive off, and felt the need to have the conversation once again with his son, because he'd had it originally when he learned how to drive, but to secondly say that his goal in life was not to, in any conversation with a police officer, that he just needed to come home alive. How he should speak to him, how he should show respect to him, how he should be deferential to that person in order to make sure that they came home alive. And that's not a conversation that white families have to have with their children.
Should we be hearing more about this than we are hearing in this whole presidential election year and discussions?
Well, I think that we will continue to have this conversation. The fact that the governor was able to put such incredible police reform legislation in place in such a short period of time, but that people are still marching, means that people recognize that police reform is one area. But now let's look at housing reform. Now let's look at the prison industrial complex, that racism doesn't just raise its ugly head in one area, but that it is pervasive in our community and in our society. And so now that everyone has been woken to that fact, I believe that once people wake up, that they're going to stay awake, and that we will continue to speak to this well into November, and that our candidates will have to continue to speak on this, and it's up to us to hold them accountable.
And is there also a need to, I guess, drum home the message of the impact of, you know, what we've all, to some extent, been dealing with in one form or another, this whole COVID-19 pandemic? The real impact of that in brown and black communities.
And yes.
The disparity there.
Yes, it is important. We decided, the New York Urban League decided, that we wanted to have a virtual town hall about 2 weeks into the New York pause. Actually, we decided at the beginning of the New York pause to do the virtual town hall, and about 2 weeks in, we actually held it. And the reason why we held it is we thought that usually when things impact white America, they can impact African American America even more so. And so we thought that that impact would be one of economic. If people had to stay stop working and have to go home, that there would be this huge impact on the African American community. We often refer to the term that if white America has a cold, that black America would have pneumonia. And so we decided to do these virtual town halls. At that time, they were just passing the first version of the CARES Act, and hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers were, you know, heading to the hospital and or coming down with this disease. Literally 3 days before our first virtual town hall, the numbers started to come out in Milwaukee, in Detroit, also in Louisiana, and then in New York, that African Americans were dying at a larger rate, that we represented a huge amount of up to 40% of the deaths from COVID-19, and found that it was because we have underlying health conditions, because we live in crowded conditions, and so there isn't that opportunity for social distancing. We were concentrated in roles of essential workers, and then we were also working in hospitals themselves. And so as a result of that, particularly in New York City, that there was a higher incidence of deaths of African Americans. As time went on, we unfortunately found that Latino men were also extremely susceptible to the disease, not only getting it, but actually losing their lives as a result of it. Then as time went on, we found out that it was also particularly a case for our older individuals who are in nursing homes and that sort of place and space. And so the issues that we were having have only been exacerbated through COVID-19. And so it's important as we go forward. And one of the things that we do give our mayor, Mayor de Blasio, credit for is the race and equity task force that he has put together that is led by Deputy Mayor Phil Thompson and his wife, the First Lady, Shirlane McCray, that is looking particularly at how these racial inequities have impacted our communities and what we can do about it going forward.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, we have felt in communities of color have felt the impact of the pandemic in a way that almost probably can't be comprehended by some other communities. In terms of the severity of this. And, you know, a lot of this information is only going to come out after all of this hopefully is over. But there's also this big factor that we keep hearing about every day, basically, in the news, because it is important that this hasn't just gone away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a very good possibility, according to the people who know these things, that we could be facing round two of this. And no one really knows exactly how severe that might be. So we have to have, I guess what I'm saying is, hopefully we've learned some lessons from round one that can be applied, especially in communities of color, to help address the impact of any potential second outbreak. And hopefully that's enough of a priority on the part of policymakers. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No. It's a extremely good point. And we have learned some things. We've learned some things through the impact and the positive effect of social distancing, through being able to, you know, constantly wash our hands, to be able to provide individuals with important PPE equipment. And so we'll continue to do that and put those policies and put those practices into place. But we do not have a vaccine. And so until we have a vaccine, we will need to continue to do this work and continue to educate our communities. But the inequality that has been underscored through COVID-19 is something that we as individuals who do this work need to make sure that we are continue to fight for, and make sure that our nonprofit organizations are there in order to support our communities, and that we continue to fight for the resources that our communities need in order to succeed, heal, and go forward.
What keeps you optimistic in the work that you're doing and in discussions like the one we're having today?
Mm-hmm. I think what keeps me optimistic is that the work of allies, and I think that the work of allies has increased over the course of the last few years, and it certainly is in the course of the last few weeks. I think that the role of our legislators has been incredible. The fact, as I mentioned, that they were able to pull out legislation that they have been fighting and working for years, and to be able to implement that in such a swift way. I cannot thank enough Andrea Stewart, our state leader, Andrea Stewart's cousins, our assembly leader, Carl Hastings, and our governor, Governor Cuomo, for being able to put into place legislation so quickly, and for those advocates. The fact is that, you know, I've Reverend Al, his work that he's done, the work of the NAACP president, Hazel Dukes, they have been doing this work for decades. And I often talk to Hazel Dukes and I say, how have you been able to do this work? She's been doing it longer than I've been alive. And the fact is that she's able to keep hopeful because every generation is responsible for doing this work and for moving it a little bit forward. And I know that we can do that. And that's what keeps me hopeful. And then finally, the work of our young professionals, the individuals who have careers and opportunities that are responsible, that those opportunities are available because of the work of civil rights leaders. And so I know that they will do even more, that they will accomplish even more than my parents were able to do and more than I was able to do. And so those are the things that keep me inspired and that keep me hopeful.
And do you think that it is possible for areas that have been devastated when there have been incidents of violence taking place, for those areas to rebuild, to be re-energized?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it just takes a set of strategic investment. I think that it's important for us to, you know, in Ferguson, we have an urban league that is there in St. Louis. And so they were able to build an empowerment center that was specifically focused on the needs of African-American males, providing them with opportunities for job internships, mentoring, exposing them to cultural events. And it's that investment that's important. It's also to invest in, obviously, the redevelopment of those buildings, of the real estate that's there, and not only to invest in it so that there's gentrification, but to invest in it so that individuals are actually able to own and operate some of those businesses themselves. There's a lot of criticism that says, why are people burning down their own communities and their own neighborhoods? Well, the fact is that the ownership of the people that are living there, of the structures and the businesses in that community, is very, very small. So, you know, I'm not justifying it. I don't believe in people vandalizing their neighborhoods and their blocks. But however, they didn't own anything in those neighborhoods and their blocks, and so they didn't feel like they were burning anything that belonged to them. And so, in reinvesting in a community, it's important that investment is something that community members are able to feel and be a part of. And so I think that there's opportunities for the development of those communities. There's the opportunity for the development of entrepreneurs and individuals who are real stakeholders in their communities.
Our guest on our program today, Arva Rice, who is president and CEO of New York's Urban League. Would you give the website for the Urban League, New York Urban League, that you mentioned earlier?
Absolutely. It's www.nyul.org.
And what specifically can you use? What could people who are listening to our discussion today be helpful with?
Oh, sure. So I think that if individuals want to contribute to our COVID Family Fund, as I mentioned, we are helping and supporting individuals who are still struggling for basic needs. And so we're providing cash assistance to those individuals. So if they can help and invest in that, that would be fantastic. We are working to close the gap in income inequality by providing educational and employment programming. So investing in the work and the critical work of the Urban League is something that we're helpful and supportive. And we also want to be supportive supportive of individuals who are starting conversations in their companies who are looking to diversify their staffing. So we also want to partner with them as well so they can reach out to us and we can talk about partnership opportunities.
Arva, thank you very much for joining us on our program. Wonderful discussion. Certainly good luck continued with your work, the work of New York Urban League.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful discussion, and one of many that we are going to be having here on WFAN throughout the summer surrounding this topic of Black Lives Matter. Arva Rice, President, CEO of New York's Urban League. Ann Liguori is along talking golf at 7 this morning. This is Bob Salter.